Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 4 of The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeological artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last season took us on a roller coaster of a journey, beginning with the devastation of the First Crusade on the Rhineland, through the rise of anti-Jewish tropes like the boy martyr, blood libel, and host desecration, moving to anti-Jewish mob attacks and pogroms in France, England, Africa, and Spain, the disputations of Paris and Barcelona, at which the Talmud itself was put on trial and later burned, and finally culminating in the Spanish Inquisition itself. We also met some Jewish heroes who would rise to challenge the anti-Semitism around them, people like Rashi, Maimonides, and Nachmanides. This season will begin right where last season left off, in the wake of the expulsion of Jews from Spain in 1492. But with this season, we are emerging from the Middle Ages into a new period in world history, the Renaissance. The world has become way more complicated, now comprising multiple empires, hundreds of independent kingdoms, and, with the rise of sea travel and the invention of the printing press, has become increasingly interconnected. Not only that, but this season our story will reach a new continent as Jews entered the Americas for the first time. This season also takes place during an extraordinarily significant period to modern listeners. During the course of this season, Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo were creating their most famous works. King Henry VIII and his famous wives lived and died in England. Copernicus published his famous treatise on the celestial orbits. William Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet, and both the Mercator map and the Gregorian calendar were published. Given all of this, to set the scene for what is to come, it will be necessary for a major geopolitical update on the world at the turn of the 16th century. To make this as digestible as possible, we'll start our tour in the Americas and work our way east. Just a warning, this may seem overwhelming at first, so grab a map to follow along if you need. As promised, we'll start our tour of the 16th century world in North America. In the frigid tundra of what is now northern Canada lived the Inuit, a people famous for their fishing and hunting prowess and their unique snow homes called igloos. Shortly after the Inuit arrived, the Vikings, a pagan people originating from Scandinavia, traveled to the northeastern coast of Canada by sea as well. In the warmer climates to the south, swathed with forests and great plains, hundreds of independent indigenous tribes lived a semi-nomadic lifestyle, together occupying nearly all of the North American landmass. Moving further south, in the tropical heat of Central America, the Aztec Empire, known for their magnificent cities, bustling markets, and unique agricultural practices, ruled southern Mexico. On the west coast of South America, the Incas, who raised llamas and alpacas, engaged in unique forms of agriculture, and wore brightly colored clothing, ruled. At this point in history, aside from occasional encounters between the Inuit and the Vikings, there had been no contact between the peoples of the Americas and the rest of the world's population. Across the sea, 16th century Europe was a roiling mess of hundreds of kingdoms, dynasties, and empires, all vying for control. On the southern tip of the Iberian Peninsula, the Kingdom of Portugal sat in its modern-day location, and was ruled by King Manuel I, a man keen on discovering new maritime trade routes to improve the Portuguese economy. Just east of Portugal was the newly formed Kingdom of Spain, ruled by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, the same monarchs who launched the Spanish Inquisition. Straddling the border between Spain and France was the small kingdom of Navarre, which at the turn of the 16th century was embroiled in civil war. Directly to the east of Navarre, the Kingdom of France sat just where it is today, ruled by King Louis XII, who was in the thick of war with the various Italian kingdoms. Just off the northeast coast of France, the kingdoms of England and Scotland sat in their modern-day locations, each ruled by an independent king. England and France had recently signed a treaty agreeing to a short period of peace, but they continued to compete for territory as each attempted to expand their area. Further east, the Archduchy of Austria, which at that time was controlled by the powerful Habsburg family, sat. The Habsburgs had started as humble lords of a single German castle, but over the following years had risen to become German kings, and eventually, both through conquest and clever marriage alliances, had gained control of a good deal of Europe. South of Austria was modern-day Italy, which at this time was divided into a bunch of small kingdoms. The three biggest of these were the Papal States, which were ruled by the Pope, the large Kingdom of Naples to the south, and the Republic of Venice, which encompassed northern Italy and wrapped around to include the west coast of Croatia. The rest of Central Europe was chopped up into a bunch of small independent municipalities, extending all the way east to Poland's western border. Moving into Eastern Europe, the Kingdom of Bohemia, an imperial state of the Holy Roman Empire, sat in the area of the modern-day Czech Republic. Next to it were the large independent kingdoms of Hungary, Poland, and Lithuania. Modern-day Russia at that time was called the Duchy of Muscovy, a largely consolidated territory ruled by the Grand Princes of Moscow. This territory would later be united under Ivan the Terrible in the mid-16th century. Just south of the Kingdom of Hungary, stretching down through Greece and across most of Turkey, was the Ottoman Empire, a great Muslim empire which will play a big role in the events of this season. Moving to the Far East, the land that had previously been controlled by the Great Mongolian Empire had now fractured into various smaller khanates. In China, the great Ming Dynasty ruled. Heading down to the Middle East, the Mamluk Sultanate, an empire of Muslim slave soldiers who we'll hear more about this season, had recently gained control over modern-day Israel, Lebanon, and Egypt. Finally, the rest of Africa was ruled by various small independent tribes or kingdoms. Now, if you didn't get all that, don't worry. The point was just to give you a general overview of the scope of the world at this time. As we touch on various regions, I will give you some more detail, and you'll end up with the context you need to understand the Jewish history that follows. Now, with that out of the way, let's continue with our Jewish story. Last season ended with the Jews being expelled from the Kingdom of Spain, spearheaded by King Ferdinand, Queen Isabella, and the Grand Inquisitor, Tomás de Torquemada. The Jews had to leave in a hurry, and were scrambling to figure out a safe place to go next. There were really three main options for these Spanish Jews. One was to hop on a ship and head east across the sea, toward the growing Ottoman Empire, where Jews were being welcomed. A second option was to head either north into Navarre, or south to Morocco, where there had been a continuous Jewish presence for centuries. But the most popular option for escape was to move west, across the land border, into Portugal. But Portugal wasn't exactly a utopia for Jews. In 1492, the kingdom was ruled by King João II, a devout and somewhat ruthless Christian in his late 30s, who is best known for his obsession with conquering Africa. Portugal was known to have some of the best and fastest ships in the world, and during his time as king, João sent several delegations of Portuguese sailors south to capture land along the West African coast, to find gold, and to capture slaves to trade on the European slave markets. Some of the wealthier Jews of Spain could see that these multiple expeditions to Africa were stressing Portugal's economy, and they saw a potential opportunity for escape. In 1492, a delegation of wealthy Spanish Jews offered King João 60,000 cruzados, the Portuguese currency at the time, to allow 630 Jewish families to permanently resettle in Portugal. This was a large sum of money, and João needed it badly to continue funding his African conquest, so he agreed. But the wealthy Spanish Jews did not want to leave the poorer Jews vulnerable, and so they negotiated a second deal with the king, allowing additional Spanish Jews to enter Portugal temporarily, for a maximum of 8 months, and for a price of 8 cruzados per person. Once their 8-month stay was up, the king would provide these Jews ships on which to travel to Morocco, where they could settle more permanently. Ultimately, 80,000 poorer Jews took advantage of this deal, and fled to Portugal for their 8-month tenure. However, there was a problem. Remember that, as per the expulsion order, the Jews of Spain were only allowed to leave with whatever they could carry on their backs, and had to leave all of their property and valuables behind. The result was that many of these poorer Jews could not even afford to pay the 8 cruzados required of them, and King João was not about to allow any Jew into his kingdom for free. The king decided that any Jewish refugee in Portugal who was unable to pay the necessary fee would become personal slaves of the king, effective immediately. The Jewish slaves were captured and divided up between the king himself and the members of his royal court. But there was a second problem. Among the Jews who Joao had enslaved were hundreds or even thousands of children. What was the king to do with them? Well, as it happens, King Joao had a particular project in mind. Portuguese sailors had recently discovered an uninhabited island off the west coast of Africa called São Tomé, which the king was eager to turn into a Portuguese colony. So he decided to separate the enslaved Jewish children from their parents, forcibly converted them to Christianity, and forced them onto ships to set sail for the island. There, they were put to work on sugar and cocoa farms and were bred with African slaves who had also been shipped to the island, thus growing the slave population there. João's ultimate goal was that after 20 or 30 years of slavery, he could set the island's population free and would be left with a loyal Christian Portuguese community there. Unfortunately for him, of the more than 1,000 Jewish slaves who were brought to the island, over half were killed by disease or famine, leaving just a few hundred survivors. As for those wealthy Jews who had been able to escape slavery, even they didn't have it easy. In 1493, just 1 year after they arrived, King João ordered all synagogues and yeshivot to be closed, and demanded that all Jewish texts and paraphernalia in Portugal should be brought to the Great Synagogue in Lisbon, where they were publicly burned. King João died of illness less than 2 years later, and named the queen's younger brother, Manuel I, as his successor. Manuel ascended the throne in 1495, in his mid-20s, and in many ways was the spitting image of his predecessor. He had somewhat of a brutal mind, was very keen to continue the exploration in Africa, and he despised the Jews. The year after his ascension to the throne, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain proposed that Manuel marry their daughter, Isabella, a union that would cement a major alliance between the two great European powers. But the Spanish monarchs attached a condition to the offer. If Manuel wished to marry Isabella, he would first have to expel all Jews and Muslims from his kingdom. Now, King Manuel had no real ethical problem with getting rid of his kingdom's Jews, but he did have some concerns about the implications of the expulsion on Portugal's struggling economy. So he came up with a plan that would allow him to have his cake and eat it too. In early 1497, on the first night of Passover, soldiers swept through the Jewish neighborhoods of Portugal in a massive raid. Any Jewish child over the age of 2 was separated from their parents and enslaved, many being packed into ships and sent to join the slave population of São Tomé. The parents, thousands of them, were captured and sent to Lisbon, where they were told that they had 10 months either to convert to Christianity or to leave Portugal entirely. If they converted, they would be protected from persecution for at least 20 years. While they contemplated this choice, they were imprisoned in an ancient palace, intermittently starved for days at a time, and beaten for the guards' entertainment. Many of the imprisoned Jews died of malnutrition or abuse before they ever had a chance to choose. Those that survived were ultimately dragged by their hair to the front of the palace and forced to choose either conversion or death. In the following years, King Manuel largely kept his promise to the Portuguese conversos, who were spared from any formal inquisition. However, there continued to be outbreaks of violence against them by local mobs or church officials. The most notable of these was in Lisbon in the spring of 1506, after a converso suggested that a reflection of light in a portrait of Jesus was not a miracle but just an effect of the candlelight. The man was dragged out of the church and beaten to death for blasphemy, an event which kicked off a massacre in which local mobs, foreign soldiers, and Dominican friars slaughtered 2,000 of Lisbon's conversos in just 3 days. The streets were said to have been so littered with corpses that they had to be burned on massive pyres to dispose of them. The friars responsible for the massacre were ultimately convicted and executed by the Portuguese government, but the event sparked panic among the conversos, who began to seriously question their safety in Portugal. King Manuel could sense the growing anxiety in his converso population and feared the economic impact on his kingdom should they begin to flee. So he began to enact laws restricting their movement and banned any converso from leaving Portugal. The only exceptions were converso traders, whose jobs were vital to the Portuguese economy and who had to be able to move freely along trade routes and liaise with their contacts along the way. And so, the Portuguese conversos uneasily remained in Portugal, many remaining committed to their Judaism, though having to practice in secret. In 1521, King Manuel died and was succeeded by his son, João III, a ruler who would alter life for conversos in Portugal forever. While the Jews and conversos of Western Europe were in turmoil, Italy was watching it all with keen attention. As I mentioned earlier, Italy at this point in history was made up of a collection of small independent kingdoms, one of which was the Republic of Venice. At the turn of the 16th century, Venice was at the peak of its power, having a strong fleet of ships and a booming economy. In the preceding decade, Italy had been rocked by war, both internally and with neighboring France and Spain. This had left many of the Italian states in disarray, and the large and well-organized Republic of Venice had taken advantage by conquering some territory on the mainland. The expansion of Venice began to worry the Pope and Holy Roman Emperor, and so, to put Venice in its place and prevent further conquest, the two leaders brought together a coalition of Roman, French, and Aragonese armies, known as the League of Cambrai. In 1516, after an 8-year-long war, the League of Cambrai ultimately beat Venice's armies, leaving the Republic smaller, weaker, and poorer than before. After the War of the League of Cambrai, the Republic of Venice set to rebuilding itself and leaned heavily on their Jewish population to do it. Jewish moneylenders were forced to forgive debts or make loans to the government which would never be repaid. They were taxed heavily, and Jewish merchants were forced to purchase expensive work permits every 15 days in order to sell their wares on the island. Most of the Republic's Jews at this time were poor, working as either pawnbrokers, moneylenders, or rag sellers. And although most worked on the island of Venice itself, they were forbidden from staying there past sundown, forcing them to undertake long daily commutes from their homes on the mainland. Being a religious republic, Christian citizens of Venice were discouraged from interacting with Jews, and Jews were forced to wear special identifying badges when out in public, so that Christians could steer clear of them. But just like in Portugal, the Venetian government was in the middle of one big contradiction. They simultaneously hated the Jews, but also needed them to help keep the Republic's economy afloat. With rising anti-Semitism throughout Europe, Venice's government began to worry that Jews might start to leave the Republic to seek work elsewhere, particularly in the independent seaside kingdom of Ancona, which was still outside of the Pope's control. To prevent this eventuality, the government of Venice came up with a novel solution. In 1516, they established a Jewish ghetto, perhaps the first in the world, called the Ghetto Nuovo. The ghetto was built in an abandoned copper foundry, located right next to a garbage dump. The foundry had initially been populated by rickety wooden shacks, but following its abandonment, noblemen had begun to build tenement buildings there, which they rented out to local cloth workers. Once the Jewish ghetto was created, however, all the prior tenants of these buildings were evicted, and every Venetian Jew was forced to move in immediately. To add insult to injury, and to further add to Venice's bank account, Jews were charged much higher rent than any previous tenants had been. The Ghetto Nuovo was a partially open ghetto. During the day, Jews and Gentiles could come and go as they pleased, but at night the gates were sealed, trapping the Jews inside. But as the 1520s began, despite this new and harsh living condition, Jewish culture in Venice thrived. Venetian Jews had begun to diversify their occupations, now working as doctors, musicians, dancers, cloth sellers, and in other lines of work. And, just as it had across Europe, the religious life of Jews in Venice had been overtaken by a new craze, a renewed interest in the idea of the coming of the Messiah. Jewish tradition was rich with predictions and stories about the Messiah's coming from the Apocrypha, the Talmud, rabbinic commentary, and Kabbalistic tradition. The prevailing idea was that a period of intense darkness would be followed by the Messiah's coming and an ushering in of an era of peace and prosperity for the Jewish people, including the return of all Jews to Israel. Well, as you can imagine, following the expulsion of Jews from Europe, the Inquisition, and bouts of the plague, the turn of the 16th century seemed almost destined to be the beginning of the Messianic era. There was actually somewhat of a competition among Jewish thinkers as to who could accurately predict the correct date of the Messiah's coming. On the Croatian peninsula, part of the Republic of Venice, a man named Asher Lamlin Reutlingen claimed that if Jews atoned for their sins, the Messiah would appear within 6 months. He was able to whip up a good deal of excitement, with fast days held in Jewish communities throughout northern Italy, southern Germany, and beyond in response to his claims. The chief rabbi of Rome, Bonnette Lattes, took a different approach. De Lattes was not just a rabbi, but also an astronomer and physician, and he used his interest in science to attempt to predict the Messiah's coming. Using a ring dial he invented, he calculated the altitude of the stellar and solar bodies by day and night, and determined that in the year 1505, Jupiter and Saturn would be in the right alignment to allow for the Messiah's coming. Rabbi Avraham ben Eliezer Halevi, a seasoned Sephardic rabbi and Kabbalist, made his own prediction that the Messiah would come in the year 1523. But no matter which sage you subscribed to, the Messiah's coming seemed imminent. And with the backdrop of this messianic fervor, an unexpected visitor would arrive in Venice who would become a central figure in a remarkable story. Around Hanukkah time in the year 1523, a boat carrying a stranger docked in Venice, a man calling himself David Hareuveni. In contemporary accounts, David is described as being very short, having dark skin, speaking a strange blend of Hebrew and Arabic, and wearing fine silk robes. We do not know where he truly came from. Some believe that he was an Ethiopian or Sudanese Jew, while others suspect that he was actually a child of conversos who had fled to Jerusalem from Spain after the Inquisition. But whatever his true origins, he projected himself as a man of great importance. He claimed that he was the son of King Solomon and brother to King Joseph, ruler of three of the mythic lost tribes of Israel. This might seem like a strange and somewhat insignificant claim to modern listeners, but back then it couldn't have been more powerful. Legend was that following the conquest of Israel by the Assyrians back in 721 BCE, 10 out of the 12 tribes of Israel were scattered across the world and lost to history. But there was an enduring belief that the lost tribes would one day be found, and that this would portend the coming of the Messiah. And so, particularly in this era of intense messianic interest, people were eager and ready to believe what David had to say, and he was welcomed warmly by the Jews of Venice. Only adding to his grandeur was the reason he had come to Venice in the first place. He wanted to broker a peace agreement between the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V and the King of France in order to build an army that would go on to free Israel from Ottoman rule. Brokering peace between the emperor and the king was no easy feat, particularly since at this time in history, Charles V was the most powerful man in Europe, and perhaps in the world. Charles's rise to power was somewhat meteoric, a perfect success story of various royal intermarriages. He was born in the year 1500 to Philip I, King of Castile, and Joan the Mad, daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. When he was just 6 years old, his father died, and he was sent to be raised by his Aunt Margaret, Queen Regent of the Netherlands. In 1515, he took rule of the Netherlands from his aunt, and when his grandfather Ferdinand died the following year, he became King of Spain as well. Just 3 years later, after his grandfather's passing, Charles was also elected King of Germany and Holy Roman Emperor. And so, at the young age of 20 years old, Charles had come to rule the Netherlands, Spain, Germany, and the entire Holy Roman Empire. In short, he had become an immensely powerful man. But, as you can already appreciate, David Hareuveni had no shortage of bravado, and he felt that the first logical step was to seek an audience with the Pope himself, Clement VII. Although the thought of a completely unknown Jew being granted audience with the Pope seems a bit outrageous, circumstances were such that it was not quite so far-fetched as it might seem. In addition to the surge of messianism that was widespread throughout Italian Jewish communities, there was also a significant faction of the Roman Catholic Church who were enthralled with Jewish mysticism, or Kabbalah, believing that ancient Jewish wisdom may be the key to bringing about a new golden age of Christianity. So, when news of David's arrival reached the Christian elite, they were both open and curious as to whether this stranger could be the key to unlocking the second coming of Jesus. In 1524, after spending a cold winter in the Ghetto Nuovo, David set off from Venice for Rome, and Rome saw him coming. He was met at the city gates by three men sent by the Pope to vet the Jew and ensure he was the real deal. The first of these men was Cardinal Giles of Viterbo, a highly respected Italian friar who had rapidly risen through the ranks of the church, nearly becoming Pope himself just a few years earlier. Giles was not only a leader in the church, but also a student and teacher of philosophy and a Kabbalah enthusiast. In fact, his interest in Kabbalah was so great that he had hosted a rabbi and Kabbalist in his own palazzo for over a decade, where the rabbi taught the cardinal Hebrew and educated him in Kabbalah. Giles was so taken with all things Jewish that he had successfully petitioned Pope Leo X for a Hebrew printing press to be established in his birth town of Viterbo, from which a series of treatises on Hebrew grammar were printed. The second man sent to meet David was Joseph Sarfati, one of the best-known Italian Jews of the time. He had acted as a personal physician to three different popes, as well as serving as rabbi and Jewish representative in Rome. The final man was Rabbi Yosef Ashkenaz, an esteemed rabbi and Mishnah commentator of the time. After chatting with David, the three men seemed to buy his story, and David officially attained the approval of Rome. The buzz around David is hard to overstate, and he quickly became the talk of the town, despite a vocal minority who continued to insist that he was a fraud. Rome's Jewish elite competed to host him, plying him with gifts, including a great white horse and retinue of servants. Despite his persistent denial of being the Messiah, David certainly did play up his mystique, spending days at a time fasting, walking around in black silk robes, and covering his head with a white headpiece whenever he would go out in public. Soon after his arrival, David was received by the Pope at the palace in the Vatican. David asked the Pope and his cardinals to help him broker the peace deal between France and the Habsburgs, so he could secure his army to take on the Ottomans in Israel. But this was a big ask, even for the Pope, and Clement politely suggested that David might be aiming too high. Instead, he suggested that he might ask King João III for help, as Portugal had a strong army and fast ships which might pose a serious threat to the Ottomans. But despite his refusal to broker peace directly, the Pope was clearly impressed with David. He offered the Jew letters of support to take to Portugal, as well as a ship to sail him to Lisbon. In the year it took for these letters and ship to be prepared, David essentially lived like a king in Rome. He was put up in a spacious apartment with a private synagogue, and traveled up and down the west coast of Italy with a long retinue of servants, carriages, and horsemen, visiting prominent Jews all along the way, and continuing to receive major gifts. He was given gold signet rings, a big white silk banner on which the Ten Commandments were stitched in gold, and, on his return to Rome, the Pope himself gifted David a long red gown, a velvet black cap, and a large shield, so he would really look the part arriving in Portugal. And so, having arrived in Rome a lone stranger, David set sail for Lisbon with a retinue of servants, horses, banners, gold, and fine dress that would impress any king. Now, remember that at this time, the Jews of Portugal had all either been killed, expelled, or forcibly converted, and being a converso, although legally safe, was no walk in the park. Periodic episodes of violence would erupt against conversos across Portugal, and King João III had dispersed a network of Christian spies who were constantly snooping into the conversos' lives and reporting on any suspicious behavior. But the Portuguese conversos remained steadfast, maintaining their Judaism in secret, by fasting on Jewish fast days, lighting candles covertly on Shabbat, or cooking an overnight stew on Friday night. With most Portuguese conversos living such a precarious double life, you can only imagine how excited they were to hear that a mysterious Jew, leader of the tribe of Reuven, and possible Messiah, was on the way. As David visited successive Portuguese towns on his way to see the king, conversos flooded the streets to greet him, gifting him horses and mules, kissing his hands, and some even joining his entourage. His presence also seemed to bring out some defiance in the conversos against their Christian overlords. When a priest he encountered told David that the Jews had killed Jesus, the priest was pushed out of a second-story window. But despite this awe over David, the man continued to insist that he was no Messiah. As he writes in his diary, quote, "Some were of stout heart because they believed in me with a perfect faith, as Israel believed in our master Moses, And I said to them in every place we came to that I am the son of King Solomon, and that I have not come to you with a sign or a miracle or a mystery, but as a man of war. I have come to help you and go in the way he shall lead me to the land of Israel." Unquote. By the time David arrived in the city of Amida, where the king lived, he was riding a fine horse, had a long baggage train of mules, 50 servants, 15 horses, and 5 large white banners inscribed with Hebrew writing. And all of this in Portugal, where Jews had been brutally ethnically cleansed just decades earlier. Bearing his letter from the Pope, David was granted audience with King João. This in itself was remarkable given the Portuguese intolerance for Jews at the time, but David's regal dress, retinue of servants, and letter from the Pope seemed to be enough for João to conveniently overlook the man's religion. David explained to the king that he was the ruler of the lost tribes of Reuven, who numbered as many as 300,000 and were seasoned warriors, but that his army lacked guns, which would be vital in defeating the Ottomans. And so, he asked the king to provide him with guns and ships with which to launch his war to retake Israel. King João was certainly intrigued with the prospect of defeating the Ottomans, but he was also a bit concerned about how much the kingdom's conversos seemed to revere this visiting Jew. In order to suss out his true intentions, the king straight up asked David what he planned to do with the Jews of Western Europe once he had retaken Israel. David responded, quote, "We shall first take the Holy Land and its surroundings, and only then will our captains of the host go forth west and east to gather the dispersed of Israel." Unquote. It was a good answer, but João wasn't yet sold. It took a second meeting before the king finally agreed to gift David a fleet of 8 warships, 4,000 guns, and a handful of military experts to take back to his kingdom to train up the Reubenite army. It's worth pausing for just a moment here to appreciate how insane this all was. Here was David, a completely unknown foreign Jew who showed up empty-handed in Venice, and who within a couple of years had become wealthy, convened with kings and popes, and had been granted a fleet of ships, guns, and commanders. All seemed to be going according to plan. Until it wasn't. Although David's luck seemed to be unbeatable, remember that he was actually in a very tenuous position. He was an openly practicing Jew, dressed in splendid robes, with his own retinue of servants, and who had garnered much adoration amongst Portugal's conversos. If David stepped even one toe over the line, King João, whose father had expelled all Jews from the kingdom and who was no lover of Jews himself, was likely to withdraw his support and possibly even kill David. David was an astute politician, but unfortunately for him, some of his admirers were not so savvy. Earlier in his visit, one obsessive fan, a converso named Diogo Pires, had begged David to circumcise him, thus allowing him to rededicate himself to Judaism. David had refused, knowing that such an act would be viewed by the king as treasonous, but Pires was so overtaken with zeal that he decided to perform the procedure himself in David's name. As he writes, quote, "That night I performed the circumcision by myself, though I felt great pain and distress and fainted at the blood, but the Merciful One, the Healer, healed me in an unbelievably short time." Unquote. Pires renamed himself Shlomo Molcho and began spreading news of what he had done around town. And it was only a matter of time until the news fed back to the king. When João heard that conversos were reverting to Judaism in David's name, it was one step too far. The king abruptly revoked his offer of ships and guns, threw several of David's most fervent supporters in prison, and banished David from the kingdom. But David's story wasn't over. He continued to wander Portugal for months, giving away all his accumulated wealth and kind of moping. By the time he arrived at the port city of Faro, he was on foot and penniless, and he used the last of his money to board a ship headed east. Unfortunately, bad winds forced the ship into a Spanish harbor, leaving David at the mercy of the Inquisition. He was thrown in jail, beaten, and finally released to wander southern Spain. Next, he found his way into France, but was arrested again shortly after his arrival and imprisoned for 2 years. Finally, in 1530, after years of ridicule and torment, he skulked back to Italy with his tail between his legs. But while David was wandering about Western Europe, Shlomo Malcho, the man who had single-handedly kiboshed David's plans, had traveled to Turkey, where he settled in the city of Salonika to study Torah, Talmud, and Kabbalah. The reverted Jew seemed to be a natural, impressing his teachers, including the famous Jewish thinker and writer Rabbi Yosef Karo, who we'll hear more about later. As Shlomo began to gain respect and fame, it started to get to his head, and he began to believe that he was the true Messiah. He began to give sermons in Salonika, which were widely attended both by Christians and Jews. He spoke of prophetic visions, wore fancy coats with Kabbalistic runes embroidered on them, and would mutter strange chants that he claimed could magically bring down the church. In 1529, while David was sitting in prison in France, Shlomo arrived in Rome, a risky move given his open Judaizing and preaching against the church. Normally, this would have been a death sentence, but Shlomo was saved by a series of strikingly accurate prophecies he had made in the preceding years. Shlomo had somehow accurately predicted the sacking of Rome in 1527, the flooding of the Tiber River in 1530, and a large earthquake in Portugal in 1531, all one after the other. This prophetic acumen seemed to impress Pope Clement enough to grant Shlomo asylum in Rome, and even agreed to allow him to circulate printed versions of his sermons there. And so, nearly a decade after their first meeting, David and Shlomo were once again within spitting distance of one another. But now, the tables were turned. Many Italian Jews and conversos now championed Shlomo as the true prophet, and had lost faith or interest in David. David and Shlomo's paths would cross one more time, in 1532 in the city of Regensburg, where Emperor Charles V had convened a meeting of the Imperial Diet, the highest governing body in the Holy Roman Empire. Boldly, David and Shlomo tried one more time to convince the emperor to launch an attack on the Ottomans, preferably with David as one of the generals leading the charge. Reports of this meeting by two Mantuan chroniclers even suggest that the two Jews tried to convert the emperor to Judaism, despite the freshly signed law against Judaizing in the empire. The brazenness of this attempt took Charles and his counselors aback, and David and Shlomo were arrested and sent to prison in chains. Eventually, both men were killed, burned alive by the Inquisition. Although David and Shlomo did not fundamentally alter the course of Jewish history, their stories shed light on the intense messianism of their time, the inner workings of different Jewish societies, and the interrelationship between Jews, conversos, and the Christian ruling class during the 16th century. A number of Shlomo's writings actually still exist in an academic library in Germany, and one of his banners is enshrined in the Zadovsky Museum within the Meisel Synagogue in Prague. And that is where we'll end this episode of The Jewish Story. Next week, we will see what was happening across the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the Americas while the story of David and Shlomo was unfolding in Europe. That's next time on The Jewish Story.